Hello, and welcome to Be Creator, Serious Influence, the podcast all about the creator economy. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Be Creator, formerly known as Blogosphere. Be Creator are the UK specialists in creator events. We run category-specific shows, such as the Beauty, Travel, and Health and Wellbeing Creator Show, which bring together brands, talent managers, and creators for a day of exhibitions, panels, presentations, and networking. And we also run the Be Creator Awards, our flagship event, which celebrates the best UK creators and creator marketing campaigns of the year. Last year's event had a reach of 179 million. If you would like to see some information about our events and how to get involved, head over to becreator.co.uk. Now, on to the show.
My name is Brittany Bagnall. I'm the CEO and founder of Cherry Pick Talent, an influencer marketing agency here in the UK with offices around the world.
Amazing. So how did you get to the position where you're founding Cherry Pick Talent? Mm-hmm. Where did your career start?
Yeah, so it feels like a bit of imposter syndrome, I think, because Cherry Pick was always just meant to be my little side hustle. I guess we could go way back to where it all started was I'm Canadian. I worked for quite a long time in radio and television, and that was my dream gig. That's all I wanted to do was like show off when new theme parks were opening and when there was a great deal on pecorino cheese at the Sobeys local. And I lived for that. I met a UK bloke, and I moved over to England 10 years ago now. And I tried to get into television. I really thought I was going to be a Susanna Reid, Canadian version of Susanna Reid. And it didn't work out. Everyone was like, you're so Canadian. Just doesn't really fit with like our British news and all the things happening. I didn't have a clue. I always was lost. I never knew where I was going. I didn't know what was going on in the UK. So one guy pulled me aside and he said, look, YouTube's the answer. You got to look at YouTube. And I thought he meant that I needed to start a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And at the time, I mean, bearing in mind, this was 10 years ago, I didn't know what YouTube was. We used it as almost like a dumping ground to put all of our old clips from television. So it's sort of like, that was just like another way of someone sort of like brushing me off. And then I started talking to a few people in the world of MCNs.
Okay.
Again, bit of a bad word, didn't know what this was, but there was loads of them.
Yeah.
They were like a dime a dozen back then. Met these really cool guys who were in their 20s and they had a little studio on Brewer Street in Soho. And they were like, look, we're looking to bring influencers onto our books. We're going to represent these talent. This was before people even had agents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we were doing. We were bringing them brand deals. We were throwing cool parties. We were giving them like tax advice on how to help them figure out how to like file their taxes.
So you went and worked for the MCN.
So I took this job to recruit talent to the MCN and they were called Channel Flip.
Uh-huh.
I'm really proud of Channel Flip. I really feel like we were the good guys in the space.
Yeah.
We really looked out for local talent.
Justin Gaynor and Will Lewis.
Yes. Will Harris.
Will Harris.
Yes. Genius guys. Really, really cool guys. And it was just such a great, genius group of people to work for. And it was my first experience being in London. And what a great one.
Yeah.
They were fantastic. So I really learned the influencer scene there. When I was there, we repped the likes of Dan and Phil. Really, that was like our top talent. Genius guys. Loved them. But then we also had a sales team that came predominantly from a TV background. So they were used to selling media. And I didn't always understand that space, but I understood the influencers that I was working with, the guys that I was encouraging to sign on to Channel Flip and what their sort of like value was, what they were into and what they really wanted to do. Because I'd take these guys for lunch and they'd be like, hey, I just want to quit my dead end job and I want to do YouTube full time. But how do I make money doing it?
What other talent were on the books at that time? Did you have Jack and Finno?
They had them before I joined. Right. So they were sort of like this legend of these like legends. But we also had like Emma Blackery, some really cool, like Dottle back then.
Dodie.
Yeah, Dodie. And
she was one of our cover stars.
She's fantastic. We did some really cool stuff with her for various brands. We also worked with, there's all sorts. And I just think looking back, it was such a cool group of really local talent, which felt good. Sales team was fantastic, but they used to go out and sell these things that didn't always make sense for the talent. And that was the first sort of time for me where I was like, something's not adding up. Like, I just feel like we're trying to crowbar in media to a whole new form of media. And I probably didn't really think that far ahead back then either, but there's just things that didn't work. Mm-hmm. And I felt like clients back then wanted something in particular. They wanted to tap into a younger audience and to like find ways that their brands could get onto these channels and have the YouTubers back then talk about them. And then Channel Flip was acquired. They moved them to Shepherd's Bush. I'm going to be totally honest. I was just like, I cannot ride the Central line anymore.
That was acquired by Shine.
Yeah. I love this, Matt. I love these chats where people totally know the scene. Because most of the time I'm talking to my parents and they're just like, I don't get it. So I just didn't want to go to Shepherd's Bush every day, if I'm honest. And there was lots happening in the space. There was lots of new names cropping up. Lots of things happening. We were doing tons in the US.
What year are we in now?
So this would have been 2015.
Okay.
2014, 2015. So then I was like, look, I'm done. I thought about going. I did actually at this point go into sales for Channel Flip and I started to sell. And I was really proud of some cool campaigns I did where it was really, I thought about the talent first. And I was like, oh, she'd be wicked for this. He'd be wicked for this. I mean, one of the ones that I was most proud of was like a big idea around Nerf for Hasbro. And we brought like KSI with all the side men, and we did this really amazing shoot. We brought like a production team down, which rarely do kind of get to do that with influencers. They're really left to their own devices.
Yeah.
So we did something amazing for Nerf. I mean, that video is still live. It's smashing it. It's one of my favorite to pull up and like kind of brag about. But the content was key. It was fun. Nerf loved it. This was way before Hasbro even really like knew about this space. And that's when I realized, okay, I want to start doing more that's talent first, content first, that isn't just about like filling a brief and hitting those numbers.
Yeah, sort of crowbarring in a brand. Yeah. More part of the story.
Exactly. So then I started to sort of like, I had a couple people reaching out to me. And before I officially left, I had a couple offers from various folks. And one of them was another Canadian named Matt Hyman, who owned a company called Diagonal View.
Okay.
It was a bit of a weird one. It wasn't really one of the companies or one of the places that people recognized as influencers. Like, it wasn't a Gleam. It wasn't a Red Hair. It wasn't any of those names that we like heard about all the time. It was more of a production house. So they had about 10 in-house channels that they produced themselves. And they had a bit of a partnership with ITN. So they sat on all of this really cool, almost like newsworthy content. Mm-hmm. So it was like the tallest man in the world meets the shortest man in the world. And then they'd pull it together and make a really cool, quirky YouTube video. And they were smashing it. They had a football channel where they actually had hosts in-house that would just talk about crazy cool things that happened in football that weekend. And it was genius. They were getting tons of views, but they weren't monetizing it. Aside from what they were getting from YouTube, they weren't working with brands.
Yeah.
So Matt came to me and obviously tugged on my Canadian heartstrings. And like, nobody comes from Winnipeg. I mean, it's a little spot in the middle of Canada. Not much going on there, but a great place nonetheless. And I was just like, I have to take this job. I was totally honest with him. I said, look, I can totally help introduce you to brands and show the team what it's like to work with a brand, how to collaborate on the briefs and come up with stuff that's still going to perform well and bring you in a decent amount of cash. But I can't stay forever. I really have a goal and I really have a dream and I want to set up this thing. And he was like, whatever, Britt, anytime you can give us, come in, let's do it. He was so cool. I took this job and I loved it. Because it was really educating them on these things that I'd been doing for a long time that I kind of just thought anybody in this space knew about. They started to get some really cool brands and they were excited about like movie releases and cool things with football. We did some great stuff with Bacardi.
I was going to say, which brands did you sort of bring over to?
Yeah, I think Bacardi was a really cool one. We did some great stuff with Ian Wright and the F2. So we brought like collaboration into it that really helped to kind of cross promote the channels, bring more eyes on there. And then they also had some other stuff that was a bit more like listicle, like top 10 scariest movies.
Yeah.
And then that would be brought to you by Sinister too. So it just showed the guys in the studio the ropes on how to properly work with brands and be great talent to work with. Because not all talent, I do think that a lot of talent appreciate the opportunity to partner with brands and earn money for the content that they produce, but it's not always easy because it's your thing. And all of a sudden now you're being told what to say, how to say it, and follow a script sometimes, you know, like at least messaging. So I sort of helped them to lay that groundwork. We did some cool stuff. And then I was like, look, it's 2016, 16.
Yeah.
I'm going to go. I've done my time here. And Matt was like, oh, like, just stay on as a consultancy, stay on as this. And I'm like, look, what I'm going to do, I'll still come to you. Like, I think you'll actually get more from this.
Yeah.
And he was sort of like, okay, cool, Britt, whatever.
Did he see himself as a talent before you came, or more like a media enterprise?
I don't think that they really appreciated how well they were doing. Like, yeah. They really had fantastic channels, and they were doing it at a time where they'd get crazy viral videos, but then they also had a really strong Facebook presence. They understood the algorithms. They understood, like, they were like the geeks behind the scenes before content was the important part about it.
Yeah.
So they really knew how to build these channels. And then they brought like the talent in to almost marry traditional media with like presenters and stuff and bring it onto YouTube in a digital capacity, which doesn't always work.
No, like, no, often it doesn't. Lots of people spend a lot of money with traditional celebrities bringing them over to YouTube and then can't understand why the channel doesn't work.
Big time. And that costs a lot of money, you know? Like, there's a lot of value in doing something a bit Mickey Mouse in your basement, giving it a whirl and seeing if anything picks up.
Mm.
And I think they were more than Mickey Mouse, because they were also really, where they were earning their money at the time was they were managing YouTube channels for brands. I didn't touch that side of things. I think when the brands sort of started to see what we were doing with our own channels, they were a little bit like, what could we do together?
Yeah.
But that was never the remit for me. My focus was getting these guys brand deals and bringing in brand dollars. So that was cool. Then I left and I was like, look, I'm going to start up Cherry Pick.
Just quickly, in terms of when you move from Channel Flip and you were at the end doing the sales side of that, what was the difference in the budgets that you were seeing from, say, 2013 to 16?
Well, you know what? Interestingly, in 2013... I wouldn't say we got lucky, but we had so many people in Channel Flip that had amazing relationships in the agency world, a world I knew nothing about. Like, I used to just think when brands want to do something, they have a marketing team that goes and spends some cash and makes it happen. Didn't realize there was these agencies behind it all that were spending this cash and putting these plans together. So one thing Channel Flip did really well was they had an amazing team of sales guys that knew those agencies really, really well.
Yeah.
And it, not to take away from the fact that we had great talent at Channel Flip, because we certainly did, but those agencies didn't know a single thing about YouTube or YouTubers.
Mm-hmm.
They, more often than not, we would go into meetings and guys would be like, yeah, my kids watch YouTube all day. I don't get it. There was a huge disconnect between what their kids were doing online all this time. Whereas now, everyone could be like, my kids are obsessed with Ninja Kids. My kids are obsessed with Mr. Beast.
Yeah.
They can name drop people. Whereas back then, it was just a little bit like, what are my kids doing online all day? It was wild. I mean, it's still wild. But back then, I think where we won big was that we had those people that were itching to get out of TV or like to kind of try something new, the hot new thing. And they came into this world and they did a really good job of getting people on board and showing that, because that was such a risk to take. Like, one of our biggest campaigns was like $300,000 for Kellogg's.
Mm.
And that was huge back then. Like, that's sometimes tough for a lot of agencies to get out of clients nowadays when this is like an established, you know, we can prove a lot more now than we could back then.
But it's the ad agency going and
Yeah. And probably back then too. I mean, ad agencies, like, even still, I mean, influencers' budgets have come a long way, but it always still feels like you're like scrambling to get that money away from TV. It always feels like this push and pull of being like, you know, people have... agencies and brands have no problem dropping millions on TV, but it's like this weird feeling of being like, oh, is it going to work? And it's like, guys, we've been doing this for long enough. It's going to work. But I think it's just...
there'll be a tipping point though, because it's, I think actually just aging is quite an important
thing,
because people go into a position of more authority.
Absolutely. And like, I don't even know where the remote is in my house, honestly. And I'm like a little bit over 35. So... I do think we've come a long way, but I think those were the guys that really smashed it for us, because they got in the ear of agencies that were like, okay, I do want to hit 13-year-olds. And like, you're right, they're not watching TV, so let's try it. But I think where we struggled back then was it was like, how do you prove... this is still a problem. Like, how do you prove ROI?
Data,
Well,
we'll get onto data, but
yeah,
we actually need to get onto Cherry Pick. We're getting a lot of airtime to Channel Flip.
Yeah, no kidding. And I mean, it doesn't exist anymore, so there's no point really. But no, that's where I sort of cut my teeth. So then I started up Cherry Pick, and my goal was literally to avoid the central line.
Right.
And work from my house in Brentwood, Essex at the time. And all I wanted to do was really work closely with brands, get to know these brands who had a couple people on the marketing teams who wanted to do cool things and were interested in working with influencers. That was my goal. I didn't want to work with agencies, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I just, it was.
Why did you not want to work with agencies? Because it's just more difficult?
It was just so much like time and effort would go into things. Back then was like kind of a bit of a dirty time because I just felt like everything we pitched got ripped and everyone was like, I'll do it myself. Like, you do a big proposal for me, I'll go reach out, I'll find these kids myself. That was the mentality.
Yeah.
And we were like, cool, you try that. But then I think what people started to realize was, holy crap, influencer marketing is tough. Like, it's all about relationships.
It's so much about relationships. It's, yeah.
And if you know people and people trust you and they're like, hey, at the end of the day, like, you're a breeze to work with. And when stuff goes sideways, you make it right. And actually, we have a laugh while we're doing it. And you're pushing for me to get rebookings and you care about me and you fight for me. Like, that's really what it boils down to, is an enjoying the experience. And I always felt like with agencies, you're that much further removed from the brand that, like, you couldn't build relationships. And then you're that much further removed from the talent. So it was just like this long chain of drama. Mm. And that's what I wanted to avoid. And I just was like, look, at the time, I had a commercial director I answered to. And he was like, our clients are agencies. Like, don't veer off of that, Brit. So he was always like reeling me back in. And I just thought, you know what? If I can like make enough money to stay in my lounge and make this happen, then I'm happy. And I can get a couple cool deals in for talent that I really like, that I think are genius, that do great work, I'm happy. So that's where I started. And actually, some of my biggest accounts to begin with were mobile gaming apps.
Okay.
I really feel like people think that I'm like this mobile games chick.
Well, you won gaming campaign.
Yes,
yes,
we did. Mm. And we have come a long way in gaming. I think we've done some, I'm so proud of the stuff that we've done in gaming. And now more than ever, gaming is such a hot topic. Gaming can be anybody. Mm. It doesn't have to be the KSIs and the LEAs. It can be anybody. Everybody's dipping their toe into gaming. Everybody, you know, has got a game on their phone or gamed with their brother or their sister. So
how long did it take you before you set up, before you got that first deal?
Oh, it was like pretty much ASAP. I'd like met a lot of people in the industry that were just like, you should do this, Brit. You should go out. Because at Diagonal View, I didn't have a roster other than those couple guys that made videos. And I found that everyone was coming to me and being like, hey, do you have anybody a little bit more like this? And all the time, I kind of felt really weird and territorial. I'm like, well, don't look over there. Like,
yeah.
I have these five channels here. And though they were fantastic channels, they didn't work for everything. They were very male skewing. And they tended to sometimes cover content that was a bit offside. So I had a real small niche of what I could tap into with the brands.
Yeah.
So I knew that I had to sort of spread my wings. And if I wanted to really appeal to the masses or appeal to like the brands that were knocking on my door, I really had to be able to just go off roster. And that's when I started Cherry Pick. And so my first big client was Best Fiends.
Did you hire anyone?
No, I ran solo for a really long time.
How long is a really long time?
So I did bring in a project manager not long after I started because I felt like that would help me. But actually, I wasn't ready to both manage an employee or a team member and the clients. Like, I was just like, you know what? I really enjoy just putting my head down and doing it myself.
Yeah.
Because I'd always been a part of the campaign from start to finish, like, I worked on the talent side of things where I booked the talent. I made their briefing contracts. I did all that kind of stuff. But then I also had the experience of working in sales where I booked it in with the client. So I had this like good understanding of
end
to end. So I just decided, actually, I just want to do this on my own. Like, I felt like everything kept pulling me back to London. And I was like, oh, this isn't why I started this. I want to go back. So I went back. And then ultimately, once I got too busy, I remember, you know, being at my desk and my husband leaving for work at 6 a.m. and I was still sat there. And I'm like, hey, this is getting crazy. A lot of what I was doing was in the U.S. But then what I'd find is I'd be booking all my deals in the U.S. all night long. And then all day long, I'd be planning my stuff and doing like the admin, like the boring bits of work that nobody sees or thinks about.
So it was more of the work you were getting at that point was from the U.S.?
I would say it was 75% U.S. And I would say now we're about... Yeah, same. I'd say it's consistently been 75% US.
Really? And is that because of the relationships that you had with people that on the global teams or?
I think it's that because we work so closely with the brands, these are global brands. And so they're always just like, oh, you know, our primary focus is US. If we pick up a bit in the UK and any other English speaking territories, happy days. So they'd
it's quite interesting because a lot of the influencer agencies that in the UK market, it's only in the last sort of 18 months that they're all going to the US, but you've sort of done the inversion.
Yeah, I know. We'll tell my husband that. I'm always begging to go back. Not to the US, but to Canada. But no, you're right. And I think it's, I don't know if maybe people just thought that I was like American and I could get things done quicker out there. But yeah, it was weird. Like all of, I mean, Best Fiends was in LA and they had wanted to do a few stuff with UK influencers when I first met them. But then they were like, hey, look, rather than going to a bunch of other influencer agencies, can you just do US and UK? So that's where I started. Then because Best Fiends was such a casual game, it actually appealed to 35 plus females. We did so much in the US with US talent that like as I started to really get to know those agents and those talents in the US, I started to get other brands in that were wanting to do stuff with that, like hair brands, makeup brands. But it was never as big as the gaming scene. They never came with those confident briefs mm-hmm. and those big budgets like the gaming companies did. And then it was all just like word of mouth. So
would you say that gaming then in terms of verticals is the most mature when it comes to the influencer marketing space? I mean, beauty really sort of kicked off around 2017 and they had their ambassadors here in the UK. But then the US was a few years ahead of that anyway.
Yeah. I would say that on YouTube, that was definitely our scene, was like heavy gaming. But now with the rise of Instagram and TikTok, we're doing so much more in the different verticals. It like allows.
What do you cover at Cherry Pick? Is there anything or?
Yeah, everything like where you can give a follow, I'd say. So we started on YouTube. That's where it really all kicked off. And then we started doing a lot more on Instagram with parents. And then when TikTok came in, I would say this year, like 70% of our business has been TikTok in 2022. So a lot of TikTok.
Are the budgets the same though for TikTok or are you than YouTube? Because YouTube is sort of where people have to invest more money, you would say.
Yeah. And that's the other thing too is UK creators tended to be more expensive than US creators. Specifically, if you were a US client, you're converting your US dollar to pounds.
That's very interesting. I would have thought that would be the opposite.
No, not at all. So that was like the biggest problem that we had early on. I would say like in 2016, 2017 was every time I try to bring it back to the UK and be like, hey, these talent are amazing. They would then quickly crunch the numbers. And if they converted it from sterling to USD, they were like, it just doesn't add up. Like it puts my CPMs through the roof. And so though they wanted to include UK creators, it would only be if I could get a really good rate. And you also don't want to be that person that's always running around sort of like not bringing the best offer to the table. Like you can only do that for so long before people are just like, hey, your emails annoy me. So I didn't always want to be that person in the UK that was always bringing like the crappiest deals.
Yeah.
Monetary wise.
When talent come to you and or talent agents and are stating their rates, how different can these rates be sort of in today's market? Do you think that there has been some more standardization?
I think that's one thing that we really try to back this into for a lot of the clients that we work with, like agents and managers, more so now. I mean, I think lots of times, imagine how what their inboxes look like, first of all. They have people barking up their tree like crazy, being like, would you do this for a free gift exchange? Would you do this for this? And you're like, buddy, like I charge 30 grand a video. I'm not doing this for a free lipstick. So they have to sift through a lot of crap. And I think that's the biggest problem is that like they need to take a stance to be like, is this worthwhile? Or do I just send something out that's like, hey, this is my rates. If you can't get near it, then I'm sorry, it's a no. So I think that's where the relationships come in, is that when you've built up those relationships, like if I have a client that wants to do something with Zoe in the UK, I know what her going rate's going to be. If I know we're going to get in and around that, and if I know it's a great brand that I think she'd really like, then I can quickly at least just drop Maddie a WhatsApp and be like, hey, what's this going to look like? Does this sound good? Are there any competitors right now or does this fit well?
Yeah.
But I do think the first sort of response, if it's to an agent or a talent I've never worked with before, tends to be pretty crazy just because they just want to know. They just don't want to deal with time wasters.
Yeah.
I would say that like 50% of their day and 50% of these potential deals on the line are time wasters.
Yeah.
because people have hired people in-house, some juniors that are just going to blast, go on people's about pages and blast them and be like, hey, I've got something. And it ends up being a free. And you're like, oh, get real. So I just think nowadays what they're trying to do is just set the scene and be like, look, this is in and around. And I think where I sometimes used to get frustrated is I'd be like, you've not even heard the deliverables yet. You've not even heard the brand or the deals. But now what we do just to like save wasting time is maybe if we're not going to disclose the brand, we'll go out and be like, hey, it's this space. It like, you know, it's this kind of a vertical. It's this kind of a product that we're looking for. There's no usage. There's no exclusivity because right away that's going to drive the costs up. But what we're looking for is like a couple stories on Instagram and that's that. Or we're looking for 2 TikToks over 2 months, whatever. I like to go in with sort of as much information as I can at that point so that the client, so that the agent or the talent actually knows, okay, first of all, the way this person's written their email, they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They know what they're talking about. And then it doesn't feel as spammy or time wasty. But I do think it's so tough right now because like I know even my inbox of people like trying to generate leads and all this stuff. I'm like, ugh.
Do you think when talent agents are responding to people in the attempt to flush them out, that sometimes they're putting, is it the actual rate or sometimes it's inflated just to flush them out?
I think it's a mix. First of all, there isn't a rate card. Let's be honest. Like, of course there's a range where you're like, hey, this is what I want to earn. Like you would do for your salary or you would do for your day rate if you were a contractor. But I think when it comes to influencers, if it's lots of times I'll send something out and they're like, oh my God, I've been using this product for years. Like I'd love to partner with them. Let's do it. And so I think we need to sort of scrap the idea of a rate card, but you need to at least be fair about the industry standard. And you have to, I think really what we try to do, and this does seem a little bit like old school media, but we kind of back it all into a CPM.
Yeah.
Because for us, we like to be able to say to our clients, like, look, not only are you getting the recognition of working with this huge UK talent or US talent or whoever it is, but you're going to get a $20 CPM. You won't get that anywhere else. And then you're going to get the usage and like creatives cost a lot of money. So we'll cut it down for you and you're going to be able to run it in your paid marketing. Mm. So there's like a lot of value there that I think sometimes agencies and clients and brands need to be reminded of, that a lot of them don't come from this space and they just think, I mean, you see it all the time. They're like, oh, that wasn't, I didn't love that actually. Just have her like go reshoot this. And you're like, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
She's not just going to reshoot it. And I think that they lots of times take for granted the time and energy that's put into the work that these influencers create. And I think that's something that I'm really proud of us being a middleman. But
and educating them.
Totally. And I think that's really where agents appreciate us because they know behind the scenes that we're being like, look, that's not fair industry. A lot of the VPNs right now are like low ball central. I'll say it. Like I go to them all the time. We try. They come to us. They're like, hey, we'd
VPNs,
like to do this.
VPNs. The virtual private networks.
Legit.
Yeah.
They're always like, yeah, yeah, no, we'll get it like upwards of $30, $40, $50 CPM. And then when push comes to shove, it's always driving it back down to that $15. And I'm like, that's way below what the talent are getting paid right now.
Mm.
Where does Cherry Pick make money? I mean, we've got staff, we've got people, we've got experience and relationships. Like, I just think that's, but you have to educate them. And I think there's value in that.
I think that there has been a tendency over the past few years from certain people to really try and make influencer performance marketing.
Mm.
And it's not just that.
Mm-mm.
You know, we've already touched on that it is relationships, that it's a very human industry. And if you want to just buy a billboard, go do that. You know what I mean?
And I think when you're comparing performance marketing to influencer marketing, you're only looking at the immediate effect. You're not looking at the lasting effect. And I'm not talking about when you take a cut down of the influencer content, you run that in your performance marketing campaigns. I'm talking about when you take a pre-produced ad that you think is fantastic and you run that and you compare that to the, let's use installs as an example, as a metric. I have a client who does my head in to no end, but I have learned so much from them. I love them. I spend so much time and energy on them. They're like such a challenge. I love them.
Hmm.
And I'll be honest, they're based in Israel. They're super data driven and all they care about is the numbers. We're working together right now for me to come in and be like, but remember, you're working with these talent who are huge celebrities, this, that, and the other. I'm starting to get them there on that side of things. Yeah. And they're starting to get me there on like, if this doesn't work and these numbers aren't hit, we do not unlock budgets to do more. Mm-hmm. So together, I feel like it's a push and a shove, but we learn a lot together. And that's exactly what we've experienced is they have like skyscrapers in Tel Aviv full of performance marketing folks who are literally just like tweaking, like twisting things and tweaking things to hit a certain CPI, to hit a certain cost per install. And if they don't hit that, they chop it, they change it, they change, like they know what success looks like for them. But I got really lucky that I got really close with a couple of the guys in the marketing teams and they were like, I want to prove that this works. Like I'm going to crunch this data until we can prove that this works and that this actually delivers better value than the machine over here.
So do you add into things like that, the earned media value?
So one thing that they really helped us to see was the quality. So install to install, cool. I spent $3 over here. I got three installs. I spent $3 with an influencer. I got one. But the three installs that I got over here from performance marketing stopped playing the game tomorrow and didn't spend any money. The one install I got from influencers have been playing the game for a year, have spent 10 grand in the game. Like they have proved, and with a couple of my other clients too, one of my favorite stats is that the quality of install that comes off the back of an influencer promotion is 80% higher than what they get from other installs. And I believe it. I believe it because even if I see you talk about it and then I see three other people talk about it and I'm like, I'm not dying away. I'm not getting it. I'm not doing it. I see it again. I'm like, too many people have talked about this to not get it. And I do it. And I am like, I'm so influenced. I do this for a living and I'm still just like, I have got to get that under eye concealer. And it's because it shows you real life examples of how it works. It shows you real life people engaging with something that might be interesting to you. And especially now that I'm a parent, oh my God, it's disgusting the things that I buy and the things that I buy into. But there's no better place to show this real life experience of how to engage and interact with a product or a game or a service or whatever it might be to make you think, okay, yeah, I actually do need that.
Well, they say it's like 7 touch points before you buy, but that's just expedited by a creator that you follow because, you know, if your best friend tells you to buy something, then you're much more trusting. That's
totally
what it is. It's people trust. You mentioned earlier usage. What are the sort of additional things that need to go into budget for usage rights now? How much more could you expect to spend?
Usage is always the one word that's like, ugh. One thing I love to do is just don't beat around the bush anymore. Like, let's just be completely straight with our clients and say, hey, look, if you are even thinking of using that content in any capacity while this campaign's happening, after this campaign happens, we need to know now. Because the conversation after the fact changes prices drastically.
Yeah.
So I always just like to be super upfront about it. If people are like, hey, no, I don't even ever do that. I'd never be interested in that. I'm only looking for organic. Cool. Perfect. It makes everyone's lives easier. But not to say I don't love it. I've seen fantastic 360 campaigns that involve all that. And if that's your approach and that's what you want to do, let's do it. So I just like to know upfront. One thing that I do for another one of my clients is they sometimes are like, I don't know if we're going to use it. We'll see. Like, it depends on how well it performs organically. It depends on what the content looks like. If we're really jazzed up about something, we might then want to use it. And that's kind of the kiss of death, right? If you're like, hey,
they like
Joey,
it so much. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of leverage.
His content went live. It performed really well. My CMO loved it. We want to get it. Then you go back to Joey and Joey's like, okay, cool. Well, I don't know, 20 grand. And just throws like a random price out there. So we like to set the scene before.
Just in terms of budget and then going back and saying usage rights, is that sort of 50% of the original budget that you get offered? Is it sometimes 100%?
It totally depends on where they're going to put it. Like, we've all seen where people literally like make one Instagram story and then all of a sudden it's plastered everywhere. And you're like, oh, I didn't even realize I'm following this chick. And then you're like, I'm not. It's just a repeat of this being blasted everywhere. So I also know that back in the day, we used to try to get clients to tell us, how much money are you looking to invest in media spend? And it's going to be a chunk of what you invest. But then we got to a lot of clients that were like, I'm not going to tell you how much money I'm spending on my media campaign because chances are it's more than I'm spending on the talent.
Yeah.
And that's when we're going to dig our heels in and be like, whoa, this isn't right. Like, the talent shouldn't be getting the short end of the stick here. And I know there's value to it. I mean, like, I've found a lot of fantastic talent because I've seen them in performance marketing ads, and I think they're great. But I just think it's tough to put a number on it. I would say going out immediately, I just say to them, you're going to expect an increase if you want usage tacked on top, and it depends on what you want to do. We've got a couple of our clients right now that are looking at doing TV. Obviously, that's going to incur a bigger cost than anything else. But like also with TikTok, we do a lot of Spark. So we do a lot of Spark ads where we get the promo code. And in that situation, I like it because the talent can see, like they can decide how long it's going to run for, right? So they know they've got control, because I've seen a lot of dirty things happen, you know, where people are like, whoa, I saw my face on this thing on YouTube and I didn't say you could do that.
Yeah.
And there's nothing worse than that too, because that's also a problem with being a middleman, right? Is like the client didn't want to do it, and then all of a sudden you hear that they did it, and you're like, well, hang on a minute,
I need to go sort that out for the relationship, because it doesn't want to reflect badly
totally
on me. We are seeing a rise in some brands because they've seen that putting paid media behind works so well that they're now looking for just user generated content, views and thoughts.
So I loved it at first. At first, I was just like, yes, perfect. Let's show the brands that there's value in this side of the world that they're so in love with. Pepper in some influencers and call it a day. But why wouldn't you include, why wouldn't you do the organic with the talent and then reheat that and use that?
Well, I suppose to save money.
I know, but at the end of the day, like nothing, I just think, I mean, my go-to for a client that wanted to do that would be like, look, let's use it. Let's get it on their channel in front of their loyal audience. And then let's reheat it, let's boost it. But we did, where I really liked it was we did it with actually a performance marketing agency came to us and they were like, look, we've got amazing clients who spend a ton of money in performance marketing. They know good numbers when they see them. And a big chunk of what works well in performance marketing is the creative. The second the creative goes stale, it's Doomsville. So they would come to us and they're like, hey, our clients, even though we're telling them to change up the creative, they know that's going to cost them money to go source another creative. So they came to us and they were like, hey, what if we foot the bill for some influencer look style content? We don't need the biggest of the big. We don't know. We don't need a recognizable name, but we need somebody who's going to go open the door with their dog at their heels while they accept their dog food delivery.
Yeah.
And show their dog running around their like legs, getting all jazzed up for the dog food delivery. I'm like, yeah, done. But you know where it got difficult for us? We did it. We did some great stuff that I was really proud of. And I was really excited to work with talent who had never done a brand deal before. And they were like, wow, this is amazing. Like, I've made it. You know, you could just tell they were like picking up to the phone to their mom after we got off the phone with them. And that was fantastic. But my God, it was more work for me and the team than doing your sort of run of the mill influencer content with influencers who are used to working with brands and doing this day in and day out, because they weren't experienced in following a brief, doing this kind of stuff. And I just feel like anytime you want to make something feel like influencer content, it never really does
yeah.
it? Because it's like either you're an influencer or you're not. So we did some cool stuff. It outperformed the creatives that they were getting from the client that were like filmed in a dingy studio with like your Aunt Bessie. But I just think there's nothing beats the value in getting a recognizable face and getting it out there in front of an audience that you know will appreciate them. And just doing it right. Like, I just think nowadays, let's stop cutting corners and let's appreciate the fact that these are talent. Like, you wouldn't do that to George Clooney.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't be like, hey, I'm Nespresso. I'm going to get George Clooney to put something on Instagram, but then, like, I'm not going to pay him a dime more to blast this around the world.
Yes, like, it's very, it's not a nice feeling when you know that someone is just trying to squeeze you every drop out of you. You talked there about the people who are doing it day in, day out, get it. There has been an exponential rise in the amount of TikTokers like during the pandemic, and with it has come a lot of new talent agencies. I wanted to know what your relationship has been like working with talent agents and sort of best case working with a talent manager, what that looks like. And then on the flip side of that, what your worst experiences of working with talent management.
I recommend anybody that's serious about partnering with brands and sort of not just doing this for fun, get themselves an agent. I have some agents out there that I think are great. Message me if you're looking for any. But
what makes them great?
Oh my gosh. Honestly, people who are responsive, people who get it, people who read things, people who are collaborative and are like, hey, this kind of wouldn't work, but what if we did something like this? I love those people. I love those agents. That is Jody Flanagan. Like, literally, when I would work with Jody, and lots of times it got near the end there with Jody at A3, when her and Amy were working for A3, that they were going off roster. And honestly, they'd be suggesting people who I knew, like, you know, I'd done a deal with that talent direct before, and I could continue to do it, deal with the talent direct. But I'm like, I'd rather work with you, Jody. Yeah. I'd rather actually pay a little bit more to have you be the one that's chasing the talent and keeping these guys in check and getting things done on time. And I don't mean that in like a you need to babysit them kind of way, but like, they're busy people. So like, if you have somebody that's managing your content calendar, that's looking at everything you're doing right now and being like, hey, I got a deal for you for Visa, but you can't work with them because you're in the middle of deal with Ally Financial, which is a perfect example of something happening in the US right now. Like, I need those people who have their eyes on everything that can come to me and be like, this isn't going to work right now because we're locked into exclusivity for so-and-so. Like, you need those answers from somebody. So I love when talent have amazing representation. That can be a mom. That can be a dad. Like, really cool story and a cool part of Cherry Pick that I don't think a lot of people know about is one of my biggest clients back in the day was a kids company. And it was a kids tech company. Didn't make a lot of sense to me at the time because I was just like, they were looking out for making the internet a safer place for kids. That was their motto. Genius. This was before I had kids. And I was like, okay, no offense. That's a parent's problem. Like, if you're worried about what your kids are watching online, that's the parent's problem. And yeah, a big chunk of it is. But advertisers have to be careful of how they're advertising to kids, and it needs to be done in a safe and a compliant way. And there's rules out there. There's governing bodies out there who say what you need to do. So this company was called Super Awesome, and they had an app that was like Instagram but made for kids. I loved it. It was called Pop Jam, and it had like a curfew, so your kids couldn't be on there past a certain time at night. It had full 100% human moderation. Wow. So there was no bullying, no swearing. You couldn't share your face or any personal identifying information at all. So you couldn't have your like school logo on your top. It would blur it immediately. It was genius. Mm. You had to post so much before it actually let you go to the next tier of being able to post the next kind of things or being able to comment. Anyways, they were doing a lot of TV commercials. And then they came to me and they were like, hey, we'd love to see if you've got any influencers we could work with. But at the time, they didn't believe in YouTube because they were like, it's a 13 plus platform that's not made for kids. It wasn't made for kids. And now they're trying to unravel this and make it kind of safe for kids, but it was never built that way in the first place. So I was like, okay, cool. I get that there's a bit of a hate on for YouTube right now and what they've done and how they've built this beast. But the truth is there's kids there. And these kids or these kids' parents can put on videos with talent who are role models and who are great kids and great teenagers, whatever. So that's what we did. We got a couple of talent to promote this Pop Jam. And it went nuts. Literally, the money that they spent in TV, they tried with me with Instagram, with YouTube. And they were like, whoa, this is nuts. This is crazy. Like, it literally broke the app. It was fantastic. Then that spurred getting in front of some of their clients because they were like, wow, if you could do this for our own app that we have in-house, what if you could do this for some of our brands like Lego and Hasbro and Mattel, all kids brands? And I was like, yeah, cool. Let's do it. We could do this all day long. And this goes back to that relationship thing, was I used to go out with their sales teams. We'd go to agencies, we'd go to brands and be like, hey, look, if you want to work with influencers in a safe and compliant way, here's how we can do it. We started to do that. And then it was only a matter of time before we realized that there was like a gap in the market, that there wasn't anybody really great servicing the kids or the teen industry. And that's when we started. We created a joint venture. They essentially acquired the kids portion of Cherry Pick. And I went into Super Awesome in 2018 and I built an influencer team. At the time, we called it Kidfluencer. We grew out of that. It's now called SA Creators.
Right.
And we built a mini Cherry Pick inside of Super Awesome that only dealt with under 13 talent or like aspirational talent who we knew had a really young audience that would be great ambassadors for kids brands. We did super cool stuff. Like, quickly, that team actually grew faster than Cherry Pick because it had investors, it had a huge company behind it. And that allowed me to really experience the two sort of like scrappy startup of Cherry Pick and me like slowly deciding who is absolutely a boss that I want on my team. And then looking at Super Awesome, where we were like, oh my God, like higher, like headcount. Then 2 years ago, they were acquired by Epic Games.
Right.
Fantastic. Amazing. Like, so proud of the stuff that we've done and the stuff that we're doing there. It's still a team. I mean, they're smashing it. They're amazing.
When you look at top earning YouTubers, globally. It is kids that are right at the top.
Absolutely. Ninja kids, fun tube kids. I mean, whenever I'm with parents, oh, I feel like I'm pretty cool at kids' parties because everyone's like, do you know JoJo Siwa?
So you were building two things concurrently.
Yeah, I was. And like a family of my own. So it was wild.
A bit tiring.
Super tiring. Really wild and crazy, but like also just so amazing to be a part of that. It was just the right time. It was so buzzy.
Did you think though, when you were building the very well-funded team and headcount,
yeah,
that did you consider maybe going to fundraise for Cherry Pick?
Never once. Cake? You know why? Because, and people would pull me aside and be like, look, like, why aren't, get some investment, do this thing, like, go big. And I was like, for one, I literally don't have like the capacity to think about doing this like twice. But we had very different like ways that we did things. So super awesome, loves to work with agencies. A lot of the brands understand the agencies come in as super awesome because they have such a USP. Like it's like, if you're a kids brand, you need super awesome. It's like this fear factor of being like, if I'm gonna advertise to kids, like super awesome needs to be in the mix, mm-hmm. and make sure we're doing it right. Like they have experts in that space, and it's genius. And we launched a lot of really cool initiatives to make sure that the talent that we were working with on these kids brand deals were premium. Like understood the kids weren't like rushing home to film or skipping school to film. Like we created a whole program called Safe Fam that was about educating kids and families on how to like do this in a healthy way so it wasn't getting out of control.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. And that's something I'm forever really proud of, what we built. Now it's moved up to more of a youth space. But the two companies were so different for such a long time. Now there's a lot more crossover because youth and gaming has allowed us to have, you know.
Did you have equity in Super Awesome or was it more? Yeah.
Yeah. I love everything about Super Awesome. They're just like such a fantastic team. And I'm so proud of what we built. And where we're at with Cherry Pick, like it just... It was so nice to have that divide and do two really separate things.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot from them. Like things that I did really well in Cherry Pick, I would say that I learned from Super Awesome. Like, and one of the best things that they told me was don't do things too slow. Like don't do it when you're drowning. Don't get that headcount in when you're drowning, but don't also overhire.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing worse. And I think that was the one thing that COVID showed us too, was like, what are people doing all day? Like I'm all for people working from home. Absolutely. And like, we don't really have a set time schedule in influencer marketing, do we? And so I think that's one of the toughest things too, is like really trusting your team. And when your team gets out of control and there's too many people and you just don't know what anybody's responsible for, that's when like, it just doesn't work out.
How many are in your team in Cherry Pick now?
So Cherry Pick is 16 and my creators team is also 16.
Right.
So both.
And does everyone report into you or?
No. I would love that. That's my old school way of thinking. But I had to learn quick that that's not going to work because then all I'm doing is just like a Brit hotline. I love it. I love to do that. I'm very close with everybody on the team and I definitely speak with them all the time. But we have like restructured the team in a way that it doesn't all have to report to me. And that was a big reason for Jody coming in the UK for Cherry Pick. So that's fantastic.
Now, Britt, you mentioned what makes a great talent manager, but you haven't yet answered the flip side of that about what's bad.
Yeah.
Your red flags.
I think what's bad, or I think my biggest pet peeve, is when somebody just has like a hardcore rate in mind and they're just like, I don't do anything for less than 50K. And probably maybe the talents told their agent that and just said like, don't even bring me stuff for less than 50. And if that's the case, then cool. But I love an agent that will hustle and like make something happen. But where I lose my mind is when you bring offers in and you know that they've not even floated it past the talent. Like you're talking to that talent every single day. So you would think that if in your morning, 9 a.m. with them or noon, whatever time you're having that at, you just be like, hey, these are all the offers on the table and they're firm offers. That's one thing we're very careful with now, is we're always like, this is a firm offer. If you want it, it's yours. If not, no stress.
Yeah.
But like, that's really what grinds my gears, is when I know agents haven't presented a firm offer to a talent to leave it to them to say yes or no. Like, that's not right. And not because I'm bitter about the fact that like that deal went unbooked with that specific talent who maybe felt totally right. But I just think like that's the point of having an agent, right? Is like to sift through it. And if there's money on the table and there's a cool opportunity, then like I want to hear about it. So I think the talent's entitled to that.
Or not presenting it to the talent, but putting forward another member of the roster to hit the target.
Yeah. Or claiming to rep somebody that they don't and giving me the runaround. I hate that so much. Like, just be honest. And, you know, a lot of the agents, I love when they'll come to us and be like, hey, we don't rep those gals anymore. But if you want to reach out to them, they've gone here. Here's their email. 99% of people aren't going to do that. They're like, they're just not on our books anymore. Cool. Great. Like, let me know. I don't have time to, like, be asking for rosters every single day and see who's moving where and who's doing what. And that's a huge reason why I never wanted to rep talent, because I'm like, people do move. People always think the grass is greener on the other side. They don't see the work. They rarely see the work that agents are putting in on their behalf, a good agent. And I think lots of times, you know, like...
Or the talent manager will leave and the talent does go with them.
Yeah, so perfect. I mean, if you've got a great agent, like, you should go with them. You know what I mean? Like, that's like your best friend. Like, lock yourself in.
As the actual agency owner of the talent agency in... that case, it doesn't make the roster look as robust, because it's not about your name, your brand name. It's about who you've hired.
I know.
So it's just sort of insulating, you know.
But how do you stop that?
Exactly.
Like, and honestly, this was the one thing I loved about, sorry, we keep going to Channel Flip, but the one thing I love about Channel Flip was we were always like, yeah, okay, whatever. We sign people on like an agreement and you're on a 12-month deal. But the truth is, like, if anybody ever wanted to leave, hell yeah, you can go. Like, these people are more powerful than us when it comes to a social following. So if for any reason anyone made anybody feel unwelcome or like they were being roped into something they didn't want to do, then like we're screwed, because all it's going to take back then is like one tweet, one post to be like, these guys are jerks. They're not letting me out of my contract. They're holding back my cash. Like, you can't be that person. And I think that's where I think influencer marketing like needs to be, is there's a whole world of media that's like contracts and locking people in and not being able to move around and do this stuff. But like, influencer marketing needs to be relationships, and it needs to be like, if you're not happy, move on, like go somewhere else, go, you know, and like, you need to trust people. You need to believe that your agent or your manager, your representation is doing the best they can for you. And those are the agents that I love. Another pet peeve of mine is, yeah, like people saying that they rep a talent and then you see them on like 8 rosters.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, this is just, I feel for the talent. It looks tacky. And then anytime I see it too, I'm like, who is this going through at the end of the day? Like, are there 12 people? Because the last thing I want, I'm already a middleman, but I'm a middleman that adds value. And I don't say that in like a braggy way. I really believe in the services we offer our clients. And our clients come to us every single month. Like, that's the way we work. It's not like a one. We have some that are one-offs, but then like they probably come back again when they want another influencer campaign. But like, you just need to know that it's getting to back to the person, and there's not like a billion people taking a cut.
Yeah, which can happen quite a lot.
Yeah, it kills the industry.
In terms of the industry and lean influencer marketing agencies, your, say, competition, what do you think of the current sort of climate? Do you think that there is going to be some consolidation? I know that right at the start we were talking about how within marketing budgets, still sometimes it does feel like influencers are a bit of an add-on. But as people do see the ROI, see it's a really effective channel, that they might be considering putting this into the marketing mix from the start, or they're now at the big ad agencies bringing in influencer divisions. What do you think is, you know, what does the future look like?
So I think there's always still going to be that approach of like, creatively, when a brand wants to do something, they need to look at all of the branches or the arms that come together to make it happen. And influencers will be a portion of that. And there will always be like other things in addition to that, that they're doing. If it's big and ballsy and you want to think outside the box, like, you know, a Super Bowl ad that's going to run on TV, but there's going to be digital. There might get some influencer support in it, whatever.
Maybe an influencer ad itself.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, Prime. We saw Mr. Beast in there. So like, love that. Love that concept. Let's marry it all. Let's bring it together and let's like just absolutely blow this out of the park. I love that. I think we should keep doing those things and those teams should continue to work together. But, and I also think you can do completely standalone influencer activations and it can work, but it just depends on what your goals are. And I think, one thing that, like, going back to the different influencer agencies and stuff like that, what's interesting is I always worked with brands in a way that, like, yeah, they have in-house teams. They know that influencers work for them, and they know that that needs to be a pillar in their marketing strategy. And then they decide, do we want to invest in creating an in-house team of X people to run this? And what does that look like? You know, do we have the bandwidth? Do we have the patience to build this up? And, like, what's the success? You know, they have to weigh those things up. And I think it's those specific brands that are having those conversations and thinking that up that really see the value in coming to somewhere like Cherry Pick, because they're like, look, consultancy contracting, that's like such a buzzword of 2022 and 2023, I think, that, like, if you can outsource for experts and expertise, that's a genius plan. And you really get value in that. And that's where, again, those relationships come into play. So it's like, you can't buy that, really. I mean, you can, but it's a pretty big price tag, right?
Yeah.
So you may as well pay a portion of your marketing spend that you know is working for you with influencers to an agency like Cherry Pick, who can just be your bolt-on, who can be your go-to and care about you and want to do it.
Do you think you're going to see ad agencies, though, buying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Influencer agencies.
You know who I love, who I think is fantastic, that I think is, like, such an underdog and people don't celebrate enough, is old school traditional PR. I have never seen a team care more about a client than PR companies. I'll say it. Mm. Like, when brands come to me and they're like, I'm talking to PR, I'm like, wicked. Let's hear it. I want to hear their ideas. Like, if they're bought into it, 9 out of 10, it is, like, the coolest idea I've ever heard. I love it. And I'm just like, hell yeah. I can pepper in talent here, here, and here. And here's what they can do to, like, amplify this and supplement it and make it even ballsier and badder and cooler. I love that. I want to see more collaboration between PR companies and influencer agencies to, like, make that happen. Even just, like, standalone influencer agents working with PR companies to do those big, bad creatives.
Yeah.
Because
then they can bring the budget to it. I think some of the struggles, but PR increasingly are being allocated a bit of budget, but they, you know, you talked about the emails coming and it's, we want to give you something for free.
Yeah.
It can be, you know.
But that's where that partnership needs to come in, because it's like, I think that's the problem, is if the PR companies are like, oh, we'll build a team to do the influencer side of things, because why wouldn't you, right? Like, that's a big portion of the budget that now you're looking at potentially carving out and giving to Cherry Pick to service influencers. But you just have to weigh up, like, if you don't have the expertise to really get in good talent and you end up paying more money because you've never worked with them before, that you stupidly do, or naively, not, it's not even stupid. It's like, who knows? You just don't know. You go to some guy, you go to Jake, who says, I rep her. And then you're like, okay, cool. Jake sounds like a legit guy. He's all right. He's answering me quickly.
Here's 50K.
And then you find out, you find out Jake is charging 50K. Jake's taking 25K. And at the end of the day, this talent got $5,000.
Yeah.
And you had nothing to show for it.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I just think
that's where the good players, I think it will take time, but they will get weeded out.
Yeah. And that's what's happened. People have been weeded out. Like, we've seen the rise and the fall of influencer, like, agencies. I mean, you know, a lot of the guys, if I lose a campaign, like, you know, you lose to the guys for, like, consistently, like, 6 months, they're, like, the top of the game, and then they grow too big. And that's what scares me, is then all of a sudden, like, you almost got too big for your boots. You got too many people. And then the agency's like, I'm not getting that same service.
Sucks. I've got payroll to make.
So. Yeah. And that's who I want. I didn't want to be that person.
Yeah. My final question. What are your goals for Cherry Pick over the next 18 months? What can we expect to see? And if there was a dream client that you haven't worked with that you'd like to, who would that be and why?
Okay, so the goals are to really look internally at how we can continue to be as lean and mean as possible, and not in a way that the team needs to, like, be overstacked with what they need to get done and that they can't manage workload, but in a way that's efficient. Honestly, that to me brings the best value to their day, the best value to our clients. I want, and you have to be aware of the campaigns that we're running and what the other teams are doing where. Like, when you get too big, you lose sight of that stuff. And there's nothing worse than when I'm working with this, like, new mom in Utah who's done great stuff with me, and I'm working with her. And then all of a sudden on the other side, someone else from my team's talking to her, and we both don't even know we're talking. Yeah. We're about two separate deals. It's messy. I don't like that. And call me old fashioned, call me small town. Like, that is exactly why I do not want to scale to, like, I don't have an interest in being that big, huge, you know, floors of buildings worth of people who are managing campaigns. That's not what I want.
Do you think it will get to the point though, you know, if you are running all these successful campaigns, you're going to have great interest from clients to work with you, that you'll get to a tipping point where maybe you'll actually have to turn away if you don't want to scale business?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. And I think...
quite a nice position to
be in. It is. It's a nice position to be in. And I don't think that it needs to be like, you know, like a sassy or like a salty position, but it's just like, look, we know that this is like where the value stops, right? Like, where do you get to a point where you're not bringing enough value for your clients? And the last thing I want to do is for, like, my clients who have been with me since 2016, my clients who spend every single month with us and we give them A++++ service, I do not want them to suffer because we're like, get more, get more, get more. Like, I don't even have a sales team.
Yeah.
Like, that is how we operate. It's all word of mouth, and it's all people who are like, I love influencers. Influencers work. Maybe not every single one of them delivers the same value or the same ROI as this guy, but like, all together, this is a well-oiled machine and it's working. We want to keep it up. Those are the people that I want. Yeah. I don't want the people that I need to go out there and be like convincing them that influencer marketing works, because if you have to convince them, they're never going to believe in it.
Yeah.
They're always going to look for the loophole that's like, this girl didn't seem that enthusiastic about it and it just felt like an ad read. And it's like, yeah, don't get me wrong, I hate when that happens, and there's nothing worse than when you're like, you said the brand name wrong and you look like it tastes awful. But like, I just think I'm not here to convince people that this works.
Yeah.
I want to work with the clients that are like, I need this, and I need an agency that's going to back me 110% and bring me awesome ideas and great talent, and like, we'll have fun while we're at it.
Mm.
Like, it's a tricky business. Yeah. There's a lot of emotions. There's a lot of like egos and a lot of like, you know, stuff you don't know about. And I just think like, we have to be able to have fun while we're doing it. And that's my biggest thing with the team, is like, we all have to love what we do. And the second that we're not loving it anymore, like, let's call it a day. So I think our clients benefit from that. And it feels like a good place to be. So we're not here like crowbarring anything or twisting anybody's arm. So that's the goal, is like, we're not going out there to try to bring in new business that doesn't want to do it. And then on the other side of things, for goals and like clients that I'd love to work with, is I definitely feel like we've smashed it in the gaming space, like I said. I really want to start showing that it doesn't need to be gaming talent that we can work with in other areas. So like, you know, it was funny. I was with a client the other day and they were like, oh, I just thought like all you did was gaming. And I was like, no, not at all. Because in all of these gaming campaigns we've run, maybe 20% are like gamers, or we'd even consider themselves gamers. Like, these are people who are just like, you know, into this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so many brands can come into the gaming world, like we've seen with the metaverse. You know, we've built worlds for Adidas and Nike and 7-Eleven, and we've built worlds for Capri Sun and Mio, the stuff you squirt in your water. Like, anybody can flirt with gaming. And so that's really what I want to like try to do more of, is to show these brands that just feel like they don't have a hope in hell in influencer marketing, because it can't look pretty on an Instagram grid, or it can't look cool in a YouTube video, to be like, there is cool ways that creatively you can collaborate in the world of influencer marketing to like make it cool. And that's really the brands that I want to like talk to, is the ones that have been too scared of doing anything with influencers because they're not sexy enough. To show that like, if creatively we come up with a great idea on how they can partner with influencers, it can be genius.
Thanks to Britt for coming on the show.